I remember my aunt coming into where I slept and handing me my mum's pyjamas. We cried together, and my aunt, the atheist, told me to pray. And I prayed.
This is All the Best, a weekly storytelling and documentary show bringing you the best stories from around Australia. I'm Samantha Groth. I'll be filling in as your host for the next few weeks, and I'm very excited to be taking the reins and stealing the show. I'll be sticking around for a bit, so I think it's best to start our relationship off with some honesty. I grew up in Canberra, but for a couple of precious years in high school, I lived near the beach in Newcastle. It was a dream. I was 16, I had just mastered driving manual, year 10 was nearly over, and summer was just about to start. Then, one day, out of the blue, my parents broke the news. We'd be moving back to Canberra for Dad's work. I was so upset at the thought of leaving, and he could tell, so he said he'd go for one job in Newcastle, and if he got it, we'd stay. He didn't get it, and I was furious and upset, and to be honest, probably a bit hormonal. In this haze, I came up with what felt like a solution at the time. I borrowed a friend's uniform from another high school, I put it on, and I went to the supermarket to buy a bottle of Diet Coke and fish sauce. In my head, I was moving back to Canberra, away from my new surfy friends, an after-school job, and cute boys, because of this business that really should have given my dad a job. So I decided to pay them a visit, and on the way, I drink my Diet Coke and put the fish sauce in the empty bottle. I'm thinking how high and mighty these grown-ups think they are, ruining my 16-year-old life. I walk into the building holding what looks like a bottle of Diet Coke in what I thought was a good disguise. I tell the woman at the front desk I want to apply for work experience. Then, while she disappears into another room, I pour the fish sauce all over the office so their space would stink as much as my life. I was never caught. But believe it or not, we still moved back to Canberra. And despite exacting this revenge, I still didn't really have any control over where I was going and what would happen there. Years later, I confessed to Mum. She told me not to tell Dad. But maybe I'll tell him this Christmas. Maybe I'll fake some remorse. This week on the show, we've got two stories of kids and teenagers who have grown up and can now see the world through their parents' eyes. Suddenly, their childhood, their behaviour, and their kid choices all look a bit different. But the lens of adulthood doesn't always make things clearer. Just a heads up, this story deals with some heavy themes, including self-harm.
It happens once every 6 months or so. I wake in the middle of the night. There's a dark corner in my mind that stirs. I don't know what it is, the peculiar sound of the cicadas, the way the breeze rolls off the ocean. Tonight, I think it's the familiar brand of melted cheese on my nachos. Whatever it is, I return. I return to a rundown bungalow house with brightly coloured walls, distant music, and a magnolia tree at the front. I've lived in many houses, but 20 Pylong Avenue felt like a real home. On nights like these, my favourite bedtime activity is trying to map the blueprint of the house. I don't know if I'm torturing myself or if I find it comforting. It feels like comfort. I want to remember. In my mind's eye, it is summer. Me and my sister are playing under the sprinklers on the front lawn. Erin is 5. She wears a pink polka dot bikini. Her tiny pot belly pops out and her bob bounces. She looks up to me with a mischievous grin. I walk past the two girls playing on the lawn. down the driveway and turn right onto the veranda. I open the door. Here, I like to stand and remember where each ornament was placed, how many steps it was to the lounge, which way the doors open. Rachel, the lounge. What happened in the lounge? Oh, that's where we would dance and sing. We loved to dance. On weeknights, we'd practice chopsticks on the keyboards and sing along to an elaborate opera. I loved to dress up and crown myself in flowers. I would practice headstands and jump from couch to couch, singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I loved Dorothy and dreamt of a land called Oz. I close the door and make my way to the kitchen. We painted the kitchen bright yellow and blue and decorated it with cut-out sunflowers. We would host dinner parties. I made handmade three-course menus. Saturday mornings were pancake days. We served my guests orange juice in a wine glass. It was always a competition to see how many we could eat. This is where our beloved Orangey the goldfish lived. There was only summertime at Pylong Avenue. I can't remember the winter. And the bedroom? What happened in the bedroom, Rachel? What did it look like? There were bunks. The walls were green. I remember being awake. I couldn't sleep. Mummy is listening to her sad music. It happened on a Wednesday in the middle of the year. It was June and it was winter.
Hey, does it ever make you wonder what's on my mind?
There was no thunder and lightning, no fiery red skies. It was just an ordinary Melbourne day. If the blueprint for the Pylong house is forever etched on my mind, then so too is every hour of that Wednesday. She wasn't there. I watched the hill to see her orange Corolla come rolling down. It never came. After a few hours of waiting in the school office, we were taken to my friend's house. Then my grandparents came to pick us up and drive us back to Pylong Avenue. The police were there when we got there. I took Erin into the lounge and we sat by the heater and played cards. I heard my nana shriek and then sob. Mummy has run away, sweetheart. She was very sad. We don't know where she is.
Will she come back?
We don't know, sweetheart. But if she does, she will come to our house. She knows how much me and your poppy love you, and we will look after you no matter what.
But how will she know that we are there?
Write her a note, sweetheart. I pull out the crayons and draw a picture of my favourite cartoon character with a giant love heart and a picture of my mum and the sun. Dear Mummy, I hope you are okay. I hope wherever you are happy. I love you very much. You're the best mummy in the world. Love, Rachel. It occurs to me now that less than 24 hours earlier, she could have been sitting in that same chair. The piece of paper where I wrote my letter to my mum could have been taken from the same pad she wrote her suicide note on. Her note sits less than 10 feet from mine. Come on, darling, get your things. It's time to go. The front door to Pylong Avenue slams shut. I never see the inside of that house again. That was 20 years ago. This year, I will be the same age as my mum was when... She was a single mum with two kids. Her youngest, Erin, had a life-threatening illness. My dad, well, he had a whole host of problems. I, on the other hand... I've had a very different life, almost compulsively so. I don't have kids. I've travelled the world, sought freedom, chased the sun. That was what I had wanted my mum to do. When my grandparents told me she had run away, my 9-year-old self pictured her in Africa.
I knew she wanted to escape this life, so I imagined the furthest place from a cold Melbourne day. Of course, I knew she wasn't in Africa. I don't know when I first knew she tried to kill herself, but I think I knew it all along, as much as a 9-year-old can. I felt it. I heard it in the silences. I remembered my mum's cries, the way the hair on my arms stood up. She was gone, missing for 3 days, or maybe it was 2. That's a strange thing about how we remember. Everyone has their own versions of events, but none really can be trusted. How could they be? We were all in shock. I remember the outrage I felt when my nana buttered my toast wrong and didn't dob the Vegemite. I remember my grandpa telling me just how much I looked like my mum. I remember my aunt coming into where I slept and handing me my mum's pyjamas. We cried together, and my aunt, the atheist, told me to pray. And I prayed. I remember the phone ringing in the middle of the night. Again, my grandmother shrieks and sobs. Her heart-wrenching calls to her oldest daughter would come to mark the beginning and the end of this ordeal. She came into my bedroom, or maybe I came to her. She took me in her arms and shook. She's alive. Your mummy is alive. This year, after 5 years on the road, I'm back in Australia. I knew it was time to return home. Today, I am sitting at the front of 20 Pylong Avenue. The autumn leaves are starting to fall. It is the second or third time I've come here as an adult. I know it is a bit of a ritual for my sister and my mum as well. I like to do it, and I think I always will. I need to come back every so often to check in. I'll never quite be sure about what happened within the walls of Pylong Avenue, my home. What went wrong? I'm walking down the street now. The house is, of course, older than I remember. Someone has whitewashed over the cracked paint. I linger at the top of the driveway and look over to the lawn. 20 years ago, there was a 9-year-old girl playing on the grass with her younger sister. To her, the world was magic and it was always summer. I wish I could take her in my arms and tell her that it would always be this way. Instead, I whisper, "It is going to be okay. Your mummy will come back. She is going to be okay. Have hope."
That story was by Rachel McFadden, with help from supervising producer Beck Fari and sound design by Selena Shannon. If that story raised any issues for you, you can have a chat or get support through Lifeline on 13 11 14 or online at lifeline.org.au. You're listening to All the Best. You might remember we ran an episode a few months ago showcasing some stories from a podcast called Spun. They're a Darwin-based project producing live storytelling from all over the Northern Territory, and we're pretty chuffed to announce we'll be partnering with them to bring you more stories from the NT. This week we're hearing from Rebecca Day. She grew up in Northeast England with her dad and her sister. Today, Beck is an emergency doctor at Royal Darwin Hospital, a place that's a long way from her first home. Rebecca has started thinking back to when she was a kid, back to the days when she gave her dad a bit of a runaround.
I'm 4 years old, and my dad is my superhero. That's my dad up there hanging from the top branch of a tree with one arm. He's throwing acorns at me and my sister. My dad is so strong. He's got biceps like steroid-fed chicken breasts. But not only is my dad strong, he's really fast and he's fearless. And he might not be as big as your dad, but he's going to run rings around your dad on the five-a-side pitch. And when that guy whose eyes are too close together starts a fight, my dad's going to stick up for your dad. But not only is he strong and fast and fearless, but he's also really good fun. And while your dad's standing at the bottom of the snow-covered slope, talking to the other fat dads, my dad is hurtling down the hill on a pink plastic sledge. When I was four, we lived in the northeast of England, in this grimy little new town called Peterlee. My dad always said that Peterlee was like the armpit of the north. But actually, looking back, it was more like the asshole. We lived in this council estate where all the houses were the exact same tiny grey box. They didn't even have pointy roofs. And you couldn't walk more than about 2 metres before you stood in dog shit. Somebody had always written something really offensive, like, "Dave is a dickhead," on the wall outside of our house. And it was about this time, when I was four, that my parents decided they just didn't love each other anymore. And for whatever reason at that time, my dad decided that he was going to be a single-parent dad. Now, you got to remember, this was the 1980s, and gender stereotypes were pretty strong. Dads went to work, earned the cash, taught you how to ride your bike and put up the shelves on the weekend. Mums popped out kids and made spaghetti bolognese. And I remember more than once having to explain to my friends at school that my mum wasn't dead. She just lived really far away. The first day that my parents physically parted, my dad was moving temporarily up the road to the flat. Now, the flat was another smaller grimy grey box stacked on top of other grimy grey boxes. And this day was probably a really sad and solemn day for my dad, but it felt like an adventure to me and my sister all the same. We were helping, carrying the occasional book, maybe a pair of shoes, and an ornament of a Shetland pony that came to a sticky three-legged end. And the last thing that needed to be carried was this grimy old mattress, the first place that my dad would sleep as a single fella. Dad was at the front, 5'3". Dave was at the back, his friend, 6'4". And as they carried this mattress up the street, with curtains twitching, nosy neighbours wondering what was happening at number 67, my sister and I were getting in the way. When we got to the flat, I remember my sister saying, "Dad, it smells like wee here." And they hauled the mattress up the stairs and dumped it in the living room. There was only one room in this flat. And Dad went into the kitchen for a breather, cigarette. And me and my sister started bouncing around the room, bouncing on the sofa, bouncing on the mattress. And when my father came back into the room, he said, "What the hell is that smell?" And there, in front of him, on his single man mattress, the first place he'd sleep as a single fella, tiny little dog poo footprints. It was the sign of things to come. When I was six, my dad really thought he'd got the hang of this single parent dad thing. He took us off to B&Q, which was kind of like the English version of Bunnings, except without the sausage sizzle. And me and my sister thought this was the most magnificent DIY wonderland. My sister went off right to terrorise the puppies in the pet section, and I went off left, God knows where. But I'm sure my dad was thinking, 5 minutes of peace. So my dad got the bits and bobs he needed. He scooped up my sister, who was screaming for a puppy. and he came yelling down the aisles to find me. And as he came round aisle 19, shouting, "Bex, where the bloody hell are you?" In the distance, he heard a little voice shouting, "Dad, they've run out of toilet roll." And as he came round the corner, there in plain view of everyone, dangling in the distance, were two little legs. And I'd just taken a crap in the display loo. So up went the pants over the dirty little bottom. One child over one shoulder, one child over the other. And a quick escape was made from B&Q. It was only going to get worse. When I was 13, things really escalated. I was like this tidal wave of puberty-induced angst. And on this particular Friday, I decided that I was going to wag school. And I only had two objectives in mind. Number one, get drunk. Number two, snog Paul Fisher, the hottest boy in the year above. So objective number one was pretty easy because there was this guy down the street from us. Let's just call him Mr. Badman. And Mr. Badman used to take his van off to France, fill it up from floor to ceiling with cheap French booze, and bring it back to Peterlee to sell to all the kids. Now, Mr. Badman did have some morals. He would only sell it to you if you were 13. So there I was, a bottle of 2 quid Asti Spumanti stuffed in my school bag, buried underneath my sweaty gym gear, and I was off home to tell my dad some sufficiently elaborate lies about where I'd be that night. Unfortunately, objective number two didn't go well. By 9 p.m, there I was, covered in my own vomit, lying on the floor in a bus stop with my head propped up on a beer can. Now, rather than face the music, I did something awful. When the police riot van pulled up at the bus stop and my friends scarpered in all different directions, instead of telling the police where I lived and going off home, facing the music, I told the worst lie that I've ever told. And I said, "Don't take me home, because my dad will beat me up." Now, my dad was the most kind, caring, and dedicated man you could ever hope to have as your father. But he really didn't look like that. He looked like the kind of guy that might just beat you up. He had a dodgy mullet and a feral-looking beard. He always looked a bit tatty and had a fag hanging out of his gob. So this would have been pretty believable to the police. So my dad's at home watching Coronation Street in his pants, thinking the kids are out for the night, and he's faced with this incoherent, vom-covered teenager and two police officers. It took him nearly an hour to convince them that he never had and never would beat up his children. Now, the next day was really pretty bad. And my dad's embarrassment and disappointment was almost too much to bear. The police were coming back to do a welfare check. And even though he was so ashamed, he pulled my trophies of academic achievements and sporting wins to the front of the cabinet so the cops knew that I was a good kid. 17 came along. And I pretty much perfected the art of obnoxious. By some minor miracle, I'd made it into med school. And it was only 6 months more before I was out of his hair. Dad had married Brenda. Brenda was my fussy, bossy, embroidery-loving, floral skirt-wearing nemesis. She was nowhere near good enough for my dad. And the battle of the alpha females had been raging for a couple of years now. This particular night, I came in late. and all I wanted was my favourite dinner, a can of Heinz ham and pea soup. So I took it out the cupboard and I tried to empty it into a ball, this gorgeous green gloop. And from the living room I heard her nagging voice. Don't you mess up the microwave. I've just cleaned it. Under my breath, whatever. So I slammed it in the microwave, uncovered, of course. And I watched the heaving soup. And as she walked into the room,
blump,
soup all over the microwave. And she was so cross. She got so close to my face, yelling that I could smell her breath. And I just snapped. And I pushed her. And she pushed me. And I grabbed her hair and she grabbed mine. And before we knew it, a grown woman and a nearly grown woman were wrestling on the floor. Now, I was hiding in my bedroom when Dad came back. And I don't really know how the conversation went. But maybe she said, it's me or her. And the next morning, Brenda was gone. I'd betrayed my dad again. So Dad, now I'm 35. And I'm not so much of a handful, although my boyfriend might beg to differ. Thankfully, Brenda came back. She's really not that bad after all. And I've made my life in Australia and here in Darwin with all these wonderful people. And we can almost laugh about the things that happened back then when I was a teenager. But I guess I don't really know how you did it, being that single parent dad. But I think there's one thing that I really need to say, and that is, I'm sorry.
That story, The Good, the Bad and the Angsty, was by Rebecca Day, with story producing by Joanna Bell and sound editing by Rosa Ellen. This story was first told at Spun, a live storytelling event in Darwin. You can subscribe to the Spun Stories podcast via iTunes or your favourite podcast player. Just search for Spun Stories. And to find out more about the Spun Storytelling Project, visit spunstories.net or look for them on Facebook and Twitter. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victoria State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. And I'm your host, Samantha Groth. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton, and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe and leave us a review on your favourite podcast app.